So today my talk, as I've been mentioned, is what is my current research. That's my dissertation. And I'm only in my second year, right? So it's a work in progress. So please bear with me. So this talk and my dissertation in general, it focuses on a very specific and rather famous Buddhist example that has been used now for millennia in various Buddhist schools. The example itself problematizes the issues surrounding intersubjectivity and, by extension, perceptual relativism. So don't let that scare you. There's the title. So Nectar, Water, Blood. This gives us a kind of like hint at what we might be talking about. And then essentially what I'm trying to do is tell a story, a Buddhist history of the discussion surrounding perceptual relativism, and specifically on the example that we're about to look at. Okay, the example. So from henceforth, it shall be called the example. So, rather straightforward to understand. We have a common object or common reference, sometimes described as water, sometimes described as a flowing substance. And you have a ghost or a hungry ghost, a human, a deva, and occasionally you even have a yogin. And they all have these completely divergent cognitions of this same reference. The hungry ghost sees it as blood, the human sees it as water, and the god sees it as nectar. And the yogin even sees it as adakini mamaki, the representation of the purity of the water element. So in this, the example is taken to be factual by the authors that I'm working on, an actual possible scenario. But we can, without having to accept Buddhist cosmology, we can easily find another one that fits the bill that actually illustrates the same problem by looking at the drastically different cognitions of our shared environment by humans and certain animals, such as a tick, who only has three senses, they're blind and deaf, or certain birds who see ultraviolet light, and even dogs with the greater senses of smell and hearing and reduced capacity sight. So if we compare their environments with our own, it calls into question exactly what this shared environment is, if the objects that we perceive are so utterly different, or in fact are different. What is the criterion for distinguishing this shared reality that we are supposed to both inhabit? So this work has been in the Western sphere. Jacob von Uxgall developed this theory in the beginning of the 20th century, and with his Umwelt, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Umwelt, the kind of environment, this unique subjective environment that different organisms have and experience, whether or not they actually coalesce. There's such examples, and particularly the one I'm going to look at, they ask us to consider questions such as, why do beings of various realms or spiritual levels all seem to perceive the same object in such different ways? Is there, in fact, a common and shared object of perception? Is what we perceive as water actually water if it is perceived in such a different way by hungry ghosts, gods, or yogins? If there is this common object, what exactly is it? And by extension, which of the perceivers are accurate, and what is the criteria having an accurate cognition of this object? So these are the kinds of questions this example problematizes, and the kinds of issues that all of the different Indian and Tibetan exegetes that I'm working on are struggling and doing their best to answer. The dissertation, therefore, as a whole, is an attempt at mapping the history of the Buddhist discussion surrounding this example, and ultimately to tell the story of how Buddhists from the very earliest days in India up until modern Tibet have grappled with perceptual relativism and relativism generally. And they have produced incredibly rich and sophisticated philosophical solution. So I hope this study will thereby illustrate the interesting nuances around the development of this philosophical thought on relativism, and perhaps also even offer something towards the modern debate on this subject. So, I mean, just to make it a little bit background, why I'm so interested in this subject is when I was in Italy studying the Majjhima Kapitara and Tsongkhapa's commentary on that Gompo Rapsil, should mention the late Kenzo John tech job, who spent 2 years with him every day going through those tech. And it's just it really sparked my interest in the subject. And then after that, I had to stir up that tech with Geshe Jampal in the London Monastery. And that was also like 2 years of going through these things very, very carefully, continuously with students and so on. And it's a very difficult philosophical problem. And it illustrates one of the major issues, I'd say, that Buddhism faces really in terms of dealing with relativism. So now this the outline. So first two sections are a general survey of the sources that I'm looking at and some of the exegetes. So first of all, the example in India, in Indian sources, it seems to have been used in three main ways to illustrate the doctrine of karma, Buddhist doctrine of karma, Yogacara idealism, and Majjhimaka emptiness. Then we're going to carry on this conceptual journey into Tibet. And there seem to be three distinct phases of Majjhimaka discourse in Tibet and that use the example. This is also still very, in its early phases of developing this idea. I'm open to suggestions and disagreements. And then we'll focus in on Tsongkhapa's interpretation of the example, which is somewhat revolutionary, I think, at that time in Tibet, and also was very controversial. So the first text we'll look at is the Petavatthu. This is the earliest one that I found in the canonical source. It's Tales of the Departed, the compilation of 51 accounts of the woes of hungry ghosts that are experiencing these negative results of their karma. And these texts, they're all found in the fifth and last division of the Pali Sutta Pitaka, the Buddha Kanipaya, or the miscellaneous collection. And the Dhammapala, in his mid-sixth century commentary, holds that Uttara, we'll read the quote in a second, Uttara's mother, Uttara, actually lived during just after the Buddha's Parinirvana. And Dhammapala says that this story, this account, was actually heard during the first council, and then later became included in the canon during the second council. It also has an equivalent in the Avadana Shastaka, the same story with slight differences. So let's just read. So Bante, it has been 55 years since I died in the human world. I have not eaten anything or drunk water since then. Please give me some water. I'm very thirsty. And the monk replies, there is this cool water in the Ganges River flowing down from the Himalayan mountains. You can take some from here and drink. Why do you ask me for water? The ghost replies, oh, Bante, if I take from the river, it turns into blood. That is why I'm asking for water. So this is one of these, as I said, Buddhist narratives to illustrate the components of karma, the negative actions arise and give rise to unfortunate experiences in the future. And it's rather simple. It doesn't explicitly describe any aspects around epistemology and or ontology, but there are, I believe, indications that we can draw from them. Okay, so then swiftly moving on. Now we look at the next text. The Mahayana Samgraha, so this is a Sangha's text or traditionally ascribed to a Sangha. So of the variety of examples that are set forth by various Yogacara authors who substantiates their claim of mind only, this is just one among many, right? So in lots of the Yogacara texts, there are many different examples given to illustrate the doctrine that there are no external objects. Everything that we perceive is not a different entity from our mind. And the example is used to illustrate that. And of the many arguments to prove that this doctrine of citta-matra or mind only, illustrates one of them. So let's just read the Tibetan. Yedak dujo minam dang panam jita rigi su ngochi yin adichi pama jopa dapa yin. So then that's the translation. So the idea here, okay, since hungry ghosts, animals, humans, and gods have different minds, perceptions concerning a single entity according to the class of beings to which they belong, it is maintained that external objects do not exist. So bear in mind, within the history of like Buddhist philosophical thought, this Yogacharas, or Yogacharas who are they're very often talking to Abhidharmakas, you know, these Abhidharmakas who are asserting external objects exist, and how is perception generated? It's generated via external objects, casting an aspect to our consciousnesses, to our senses, and then our senses reflecting those objects, being generated in the aspect of those objects. Yeah, just like a mirror, just like if you put an orange in front of a mirror, that object will cast its aspect and the mirror will reflect, similar to our senses and to how cognition works. That's an Abhidharma theory of how cognition works. For Pitamachans or Yogacharas like Sangha here, this doesn't make any sense. If you have an object like an orange reflected in 10 different mirrors, and you end up having a banana, strawberry, and an apple reflected in these mirrors, it's very difficult to maintain there is one object passing its aspect or actually reflecting itself into these different cognition or into these mirrors in that example. So in that case, because there are such different cognition, they argue, there is no external object that is producing these different cognitions or that these consciousnesses are represented. So there are three, arguably four different arguments for idealism that use the example, but this is just one of them. We won't go into more details here. So the next text, yeah, the Madhyamaka-vatara by Chandrakirti. This is more complex. Have we got there yet? Yeah, okay, so let's just read the Tibetan and then I'll try and explain the philosophy. So, Rabbi Dangan or Wang Chin, Wangpo Chen Sung La, Chubak Lung La, Yida Nak Lo Yang, Dona Jita She Cha Me, Deshin Lo Yang Me Che Dun, Yi She Pat Pi. So, also, a Hungry Ghost awareness of a flowing river as pus is similar to someone whose visual sense is afflicted with an eye disorder. To summarize, the idea is that just as objects of knowledge do not exist, one should also understand mind as non-existent. So the context of this discussion comes in the middle of a large debate Chandrakirti is going through with Yogacharas, who are trying to assert that there are no external objects and they're giving primacy to the subjective mind. Yeah, that the mind is what exists. That's what's real. External objects are completely non-existent. They don't exist. Nothing to them. And so in a previous example, when Chandrakirti responded to the example of an eye disorder, a rab that has rabrit, generally we just call it an eye disorder, it's more simple, where you have these floaters, right? Where you see like falling hair or you see floaters. So the Chittamachans, they use that as an example to illustrate, oh, you can have cognition without external object. Look, it's like when you have our eyes, we see these floaters, but actually there is no falling hair there. Therefore, we can have cognition without an external object. Chandrakirti, in that context, refuted that example by saying, look, if there is really this intrinsically existing cognition, consciousness, as you say, Yogacharya, if there really is, then such a cognition of these floating hairs being intrinsically existent does not depend intrinsic. Its identity does not borrow itself from anywhere. It's intrinsic to itself. Hence, that cognition does not rely on having this rabbit, having an eye disorder, or anything else in order to have the appearance of falling hair. That's the case. Anyone who looks in that direction should see falling hair. Why? Because the cognition is intrinsically existent. It is intrinsic. It needn't depend on it. But that's obviously not the case. If I have floaters in my eyes and say, oh, there's falling hair here, you do not see them. That's my subjective experience. But if my cognition were intrinsically existent, Chandrakirti says, we should all, because it doesn't depend on it. That's the kind of central way of explaining Chandrakirti's previous refutation, and he says the same thing here. It's similar to that. So in just as someone with an eye disorder perceives falling hair, likewise here, if the cognition of these beings is intrinsic, does not depend on anything for its own identity, then when a hungry ghost sees us, since that cognition does not depend, being intrinsic, doesn't depend on anything like karma, like hungry ghost sense power, or anything at all, then the God, the human, and anyone else, they should also see pus or and blood, because their cognitions are intrinsic. So that's the kind of argument that Chandrakirti is bringing there. And there are various interpretations of that by Tibetan that come later. So here's a brief summary of various texts that I found the example in Indian sources. So earliest, as I said, was the Petavatu, 2nd century BCE. Then we've got the Vasyajya Vastu. This is from the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, that chapter on medicines. And the Samdhi Niro Chana Sutra, Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And then that last one, there's the Nyayana Shura Shastra by Sanghabhaja, the commentary on the kind of refutation of Abhidhamma Kosha. So those, all of those texts use the example to illustrate Buddhist doctrine of karma in sort of two ways. It's ethical dimension, it's also cognitive or psychological dimension, that cognitions, the perceptual capacity of us to perceive different types of objects, that's also a result of karma. So then in terms of idealism, Yogacara, Chetamawa, we have all of these different texts. So the Mahayana Abhidharma Sutra, this is actually a lost Mahayana Sutra. It appears in many different Tibetan texts, the Chinese texts, and in the Sanghas, Mahayana Sangraha, so roughly 3rd century. Lankavatara Sutra, Mahayana Sangraha, Sangha, and it's Basya by Vasubandhu, from the Umshika by Vasubandhu. There's an example there. Then in Jinaputra is also Abhidharma Samachaya, etc. Right? Alokamala, Ashwabhava uses it twice, and then Vinita Devi there in the 7th, 8th century. There's also many Chinese texts, several Chinese texts that I found anyway, that also use the example to illustrate idealism, or in Yogacara, non-existent external world. But here I'm just going to stay with Indian and Tibetan sources. And then finally, in terms of emptiness, using the example to illustrate emptiness, we've got Chandrakirti there. A very interesting text, the next one, 10th, 11th century by Jnanavajra. It's his commentary on the Lankavatara Sutra. Uses the example in a very interesting way, a kind of Yogacara, Madhyamaka point of view. And then there's Jayananda there, with his tika on the Madhyamaka Vatara. This is the only known Indian commentary on Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka Vatara. 12th century. Yeah, we'll talk about Jayananda again. He's an interesting chap. Went to Tibet in the 12th century. So anyway, this is just a bit of a survey, really, to illustrate the kinds of doctrines that the example is being used in, and this kind of development of it in India. There's a lot to say in terms of like the differences in the philosophical discussions surrounding it, but this is talk is more like a general presentation. Yeah. So now let's get to Tibet. So moving north, we continue this conceptual journey from the previous chapter along this very same tributary of philosophical thought in Tibet. My current research, it seems, we can broadly group Tibetan exegesis, Tibetan Madhyamaka exegesis, into three phases. That between the 10th and 13th century, so roughly from the beginning of the Tisha and the Chida. That's not to say there's nothing on Madhyamaka in the Naga. I think there is a little bit. I don't know very much, as we haven't done a great extensive search yet into that area. If anybody knows, I'd be happy to hear about it. But anyway, in terms of real Tibetan discourse on Madhyamaka and writing that much more lucid and oral treatises on Madhyamaka, it begins around this period, 10th, 13th century, with, okay, Atisha's not Tibetan, but he's a good way to link the Indian commentators with the Tibetans. So White is people I'm looking into, but I haven't found and used the example as of yet. Yellow is people that I have found use the example. So maybe I'll just talk a little bit about each of these exegetes, because they're all quite important for Tibetan Madhyamaka. So Atisha, we all know who he is. I'll leave that out, him out. Rongzompa is this, we saw a talk last week, Rongzom. This great Nyingmapa, huge exegetes, fantastic epistemologist and philosopher. He's used by Mipham. Mipham relies heavily on Rongzom in his own unique epistemology. very influential for the Ngmapa tradition. We have Nok, famous Nok Loden Sherrab, translated the Pramanavartika, and considered by tradition a proponent of the yoga, Madhyamaka Svatantita, Umarangyupa tradition. Then we've got Patsop Nimajak, who was also very important for Pratimagika within Madhyamaka, right? We've got these, generally there's these two branches of Madhyamaka discourse that existed in India, but Quine calling them Umarangyupa and Umatagyua. This is really a Tibetan designation. But Patsop Nimajak is the one who first translated, not first actually, there was a translation before him, but considers this main exegete of Chandrakirti's system, or the founder in a sense, who really propagated it, really established it in Tibet. And then we have Chöpa Chökyi Sengye, who's, you'll know, it's this excellent epistemologist. He actually had a debate with Jayananda and apparently defeated him in debate. I think it's in Sampu Monastery. Jayananda, it seems, couldn't uphold Chandrakirti's Bhavasanghika Umatagyua. And then Mabchöp Changchöp Sundru, so interesting, he is a student of Chöpa Chökyi Sengye, but he disagreed with him. He follows Chandrakirti, follows the Umatagyua. And he actually attempts to refute lots of his teacher's ideas. Sakya Pandita, also an important author on Majjhimaka. Then when we hit the 14th and 15th century, we have a slightly different period of Tibetan exegesis, where luminaries from all of the five principal lineages were in the midst of an incredibly rich and dynamic period of scholarly activity, also included Majjhimaka. But as Douglas Duckworth succinctly observes, during this period, the distinctive interpretations of the various approaches to the Buddhist path and view of the main Buddhist sects in Tibet were being forged at this time. We've got Rangdung Dorje, the third Karmapa, Mutona Rinpoche, Dolpropa, for the Chöntongpas, Longchenpa for the Nyingmapas, Lama Dampa Sinum Gyaltsen for the Sakyas, his fantastic author on Lamjen. So all of these have works on Majjhimaka, and but so far, I mean, just on a very cursory look through their works, I haven't found anything. When we hit the kind of mid-14th century of Rendawa, this is a, let's say there's a kind of new injection of life into Tibetan discourse on Majjhimaka, and a tradition generally considers Rendawa to have revived Majjhimaka teachings and Majjhimaka studies in Tibet. And so Rendawa, Lochen Kyabchok Pelsang and Tsongkhapa, as a free, during their time, considered kind of great Majjhimaka masters of Mensang. And they, I think Lochen, yeah, point to Tukum Jinpa anyway, Lochen Kyabchok Pelsang, possibly the earliest Tibetan commentary on Chandrakirti's Majjhimaka Vatara. Rendawa also has a commentary. And then Tsongkhapa has also a very thorough commentary. And in many ways, generally the tradition and modern scholarship also generally considers Tsongkhapa's interpretation of Majjhimaka as being quite unique, quite different from anything that came before him, and to have essentially refuted nearly everybody prior to him. There's even a text by Gyatso Gyaltsen that tries to argue why Rendawa and Tsongkhapa's views come to the same point. But at the moment, as we saw Jigyal Seren's TGSS, right, he's working on Rendawa's Majjhimaka. We just recently have access to Rendawa's full Sungbon, which was just published, I think, in 10 volumes, maybe 10 years ago. So a lot of our understandings on what actually what Rendawa taught are based on later Tibetans' articulation of his views, or the two commentaries we have had for a while that were translated, but they're more succinct. There are whole 10 volumes, and there's a lot on the view on Majjhimaka within those. So I'm hoping to kind of go into this a bit more to actually distinguish how revolutionary Tsongkhapa actually is supposed to have been. When you have Rendawa there with these 10 volumes of scriptures, we haven't really had access to before. So anyway, these three did a lot from Majjhimaka studies in Tibet. Then we have Tsongkhapa's views and interpretations of Majjhimaka that we'll see soon were said to be so controversial, and definitely were controversial. You have these three Sakya scholars who wrote these scathing critiques of him, Taksang, Gorampa, Sakya Chogyam. Each of them collectively is the Go Sha Taksung. Each of them are quite different, but they all write very, very erudite critiques of Tsongkhapa's works, and particularly his interpretation of Majjhimaka. And moving on now into the 16th century, you then have this a backlash from Tsongkhapa's followers, who also write their own critiques of these three authors, these three secular authors, Serajit Tsongpa, Panchen Sonam Jagpa, Hosen Chogyen. They write different critiques of Gorampa and Taksen. Then you have Mikyo Dorje and Wangchuk Dorje, right, the 8th and 9th Karmapa, who actually essentially developed the ideas that Taksen argued for and further developed them into actually much more kind of intense interpretation of Majjhimaka, much more, from a Tsongkhapa point of view, much more nihilistic. Then we've got Taranatha, who's still to be looked into, but he's also an important author of this time. It'd be nice to see if he had something. Then there's Pachoknow and Jampa, also writes a response to Taksen's critique, quite important. Thigme Limpo also has some important, interesting writings on Majjhimaka. I'm not sure if he has a complete text on Majjhimaka, but he has some sections on Majjhimaka. And then finally, as we get to like the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, we have from Jun Mepan, right? This fantastic Nyingma exegete, who, in his writings on Majjhimaka, he's in a very privileged position in a sense. He's looking back at these 1,000 years of Tibetan discourse on Majjhimaka and agreeing with some, disagreeing with others. So in many ways, he refutes Tsongkhapa, follows Gorampa and Rongzompa, Nyingma. But in many ways, he also follows Tsongkhapa. And then we also have Gendun Trepa, right? So just after who, we wanted to look into him, but why I stand so far, follows Mipham in many ways in his critique of Tsongkhapa, not in every way. So this is a very general overview of Majjhimaka discourse in these three periods and the authors that I've found interesting usages of the example that I'm working on and the kind of, so, but I haven't entered in, I'm to talk about all of the different debates that they deal with. But what's interesting for me personally is actually the dynamics between all of these people. So you have things like Mikyo Dorje refuting his so-called previous incarnation of Rangjin Dorje. You have Mipham relying on people like Gorampa, Rongzong. You have people like Hejo, who actually preempts arguments that Taksen then writes down. And then you have even Tsongkhapa, who actually preempts arguments that Mipham uses. And I think this tells us something quite interesting about literary history and how this actually develops over a period of time. And I'll say something about that later. So now let's focus in, let's zoom inwards onto one of the actual discussions that I'm working on. So Tsongkhapa. So Tsongkhapa, these are his dates. He argued for reforms, or probably more correct to say innovations, of Tibetan interpretations of three main components of Buddhist practice: the view, power, meditation, gompa, and conduct. So in terms of view, Tsongkhapa was very concerned with how Tibetans were interpreting Majjhimaka. For him, they had fallen under the pernicious influence of teachings that either overextended their scope when refuting and rejecting what did not exist, and thus were unable to uphold relative things or conventional things like karma and the method side of Mahayana Buddhism. Or they were overly limited in their scope, and thus they could not uproot the subtlest form of ignorance that blocks liberation. You've got with Majjhimaka reasonings, right? You need to negate how certain things exist or how certain things we perceive to exist but actually do not. And how you delineate what you refute is a huge subject of discussion in Majjhimaka. Now, what exactly is the gacha? Exactly how do you, what it is the target of your analysis when you use Majjhimaka reasons to refute how things do not exist? So it's a very delicate line between what exactly does exist and what does not. And Tsongkhapa was not happy with, as far as we can tell, nearly anyone in Tibet's actual explanations. Of course, he doesn't say it quite in those terms, but we can draw this out from his writing. So the connection between these three, the view, meditation, conduct, is personally quite an interesting subject and something I'm trying to write on as well. Another sort of separate paper on Nipan, how the view and meditation, how these work together and how actually one applies in meditation things that one establishes as the view in terms of Majjhimaka. And so For Tsongkhapa, if you have a view which over, let's say, overextends what you negate with Majjhima reason, in the sense that you, in terms of this tetralemma, you refute the existence of everything. You know, nothing exists, and emptiness is best described as neither existent, non-existent, both, or neither. You refute all of that. This has a consequence to your meditation, because it leads you to believe that your every concept, therefore, also is a grasping at something which does not exist. Every concept, therefore, should be negated. Therefore, when we meditate, we need to negate every concept. Every concept is just cause of samsara. Therefore, we should negate both. So Tsongkhapa saw this view as informing an inferior form of meditation, which also had consequences for conduct, right? Buddhist conduct, ethics, compassion, and so on, where it's remembered by tradition is that there was this lack of concern with the Vinaya, with ethics, and so on, and generally speaking, the method side of Mahayana Buddhism. So all of the problems that essentially are generally associated with Pashan, you know, that was supposed to have been refuted back in the Ngada, he sees as coming out again and proliferating at his time. So Tsongkhapa's reforms, or probably more correct to say innovations, banned many aspects of Buddhist thought. However, his followers would consider his principal contributions to Buddhist doctrine his writings on Madhyamaka and on the illusory body of Tantra's completion stage at Dzogchen. But before discussing Tsongkhapa's unique interpretation of the example that I'm working on, let's briefly survey some unique features of his interpretation of Madhyamaka. Hopefully this will allow a more nuanced reading of his interpretation. So one of the controversial things Tsongkhapa does is he integrates Dignaga and Dharmakirti's epistemology into Madhyamaka. So Dignaga and Dharmakirti is very important, very significant, famous, and influential authors on epistemology and logic in India. So essentially, they have a very different view of reality than people like Chandrakirti, Nagarjuna, and so on. But for Tsongkhapa, there was no problem to integrate certain aspects of Dharmakirti's epistemology into Madhyamaka, as long as you follow by that. So Tsongkhapa's basic point is that if you want to not fall into skepticism, where you cannot prove that anything exists, or epistemic relativism, where you cannot distinguish a sense cognition of a mirage and a sense cognition of a lake. Within Madhyamaka, everything is considered illusory. So then what exactly is the difference between an illusory lake, a mirage, and an actual lake that functions as a lake? And the cognition of a mirage and the cognition of a lake, how do you distinguish them? So one of the problems that he felt previous Madhyamakas are not clearly articulated was this, how to distinguish them. So to help with this, he borrows Dharmakirti's epistemology in terms of its distinguishing features of, or defining characteristics of Tsema, of Pramana, yeah, this accurate knowledge. When I say Tsema or epistemic instruments, quite a kind of funky term, just think correct cognition, yeah, accurate knowledge. So he borrows that from Dharmakirti, and says, fine, we can have two types of epistemic instruments. We can have inferential and we can have perceptual. These are the two types that Dignaga and Dharmakirti propose. That's how we can know everything. Everything we know either perceptually or inferentially. Then he distances himself from Dignaga and Dharmakirti by using four different types of pramana that Chandrakirti actually teaches. But he adds two types of inference and kind of implies you could have more of the inference through analogy and inferences through testimony or authority. You can have an inference based on what someone says. Oh, they say that, therefore that's the case. Or just like this analogy, therefore so and so. He adds these types of inferences that we can use also in Madhyamaka to have a coherent epistemology, even if everything is unreal. And he divides these up into these two types of epistemic instruments, two types of tsema. So conventional epistemic instruments, they validate conventional things. And they prove, they establish, they validate. ultimate epistemic instruments, they warrant ultimate. They establish ultimates. These do not contradict each other. They have different areas of expertise. Right? So a telescope can see the moon. It can't see a microorganism, but it doesn't invalidate the microorganism. Likewise, an ultimate sama, an ultimate epistemic instrument, it can perceive reality, it can perceive the ultimate, it can perceive emptiness, but it cannot, but that doesn't invalidate nominal things like tables and chairs. Then he goes on to say something quite fundamental for his sister. So objects that are positive conventionally just means conventional things. They must be warranted by a conventional epistemic instrument. From the Lamrim Chenma. So to have to just be able to distinguish the difference between a mirage and an actual mate, you need to be able to have this proven to oneself and to others via a correct cognition. Otherwise, we fall into skepticism where we can't prove anything, or total relativism where every opinion, every idea is equally true. However, he is a Majjhamaka, so he still accepts that all conventional things are lua, they're all deceiving. All objects, they all appear to possess this intrinsic identity, therefore, and they don't, and therefore they're deceiving. Common tenets among all Majjhamakas in Tibet and many other philosophical systems. All conventional things are deceiving from the object side. And then from the subject side, all conventional epistemic instruments are deceived. Yeah? They're all chulwa. Okay, so you've got a situation similar to a hallucination, let's say, of a pink elephant and a consciousness that is hallucinating. Right? But the pink elephant is said to be proven as being warranted by this confused, hallucinating cognition. And yet, this still functions, this still works for some couple. So this is a problem that people criticize him for. And he says, and yet, objects that are positive conventionally, even if they are deceiving, they must be warranted by conventional epistemic instrument. It must be proven, it must be established. You need to have a valid knower of those objects. So to kind of sum up this point, he thus ascribes ontological truth to mere conventions, despite recognizing their deceiving, and conventional accuracy to their certifying or warranting pramanas or tsema, despite recognizing their deceit. He hopes thereby to avoid epistemic and ethical relativism. So this would lead to a barrage of criticism from outside Tsongkhapa tradition and was considered a realist or a foundational interpretation of Majjhamaka using Western philosophical terminology. And many Western philosophical interpreters also agree with that. So the debate essentially revolves around one of how to interpret this term Samvritti Satya or Kunzop Dampa, and so the Samvritti or the Kunzop, right? So Tsongkhapa leans towards the conventional, yeah, in this term, this meaning of that term, or and Taktsan, Gorampa, Mirpam, many others who disagree with Tsongkhapa here, they lean towards obscurational truth. And this is really like the central cog that lots of these debates revolve around. There's Chandrakirti, who's kind of the common source for most people who consider themselves, is the common source that everyone who considers themselves in the Tagulas rely upon. And he gives three meanings of Samvritti. One is conventional, roughly speaking, one is obscurational, and one is mutually dependent.
What do you mean by obscuring,
zop, right? Zopa, like obscuring, unclear, unclarity, confusing almost. obstructing, not really obstructing, in our sense, obstructing, just can't see, can't understand. Yeah? So these objects are considered conventional truths for various reasons, in an obscurational sense, in the sense that they appear one way but don't exist that way. Therefore, they obscure us from understanding how they really are. That's one of the ways of interpreting the meaning of Kunzokdamba. Yeah. There's an enormous amount of things to say here, but just time-wise. So then let's just go to Tsongkhapa's interpretation of the example. So this comes in his Gompa Rabsel commentary to the Umajugpa, the Majjhima Torah. And he begins the discussion with this question. Let's go through the Tibetan. The Joa, they said this are those sentient beings in the example. Deragi Tongwa, for their visual perception. Tanyapitsema Yinda. They are conventional systemic instruments. Yeah, so the accurate knowledge. He's saying the accurate knowledge. Then Shichi Mutumpa Dedatu Seme Jutna Na Chak Nang Na Chak Mayim Kan Ni Yekelshin. So this is his question. If the visual perceptions of these beings are warranted by conventional epistemic instruments, not if they are, they're warranted. The perceptions of those are warranted. They're valid, they're accurate. If a single basis or a single object is warranted by the epistemic instruments of those discordant visual perceptions, then it would not be contradictory for something to be pus and blood and not be pus. There would be no reliability to whatsoever to what is proven by epistemic instrument. And so accurate knowledge would essentially no longer be accurate. Anything could be accurate. And it would be very difficult to say, I know anything. So that's the problem, right? And so Tsongkhapa's solution is quite perplexing and confusing, but I think it has some depth to it. So he proposes a mirological solution via parts. So this is his solution. He says, well, yes, because we can't all perceive the same object as having utterly contradictory quality, I can't validly perceive this as a table while you validly perceive it as a banana. We can't do that, right? That can't work. But since this example is something that these great Indian philosophers accept, we need to explain how. So what he says is that the human perceives water, the ghost sees blood, and the deva sees nectar. They all see their own unique, trivial object that is unique to themselves. And therefore, they don't invalidate each other. Each of their cognitions are accurate, but they do not invalidate each other's. And therefore, we have not fallen into epistemic relativism or skepticism. The maintenance of conventional cognitions still this, you can still have accurate cognition. And there is a solution to this example. Possibly raises more questions than it answers. But it is a possible interpretation of it. Okay, so because we're getting to the end the time now, I won't go into any more depth details of this argument, this debate. Taksang has a lot to say on this and has a really quite astute reputation of Tsongkhapa. So I leave time for question and answers more so now so we can actually discuss it. But maybe just to try to wrap up, because essentially, as I said at the beginning, this is quite early research. It's still very early days. And I should mention that a lot of this work on Taksang and his reputation that I haven't discussed. But anyway, I've relied a lot on the work of the Yak Herds, yeah, these new books that come out on Taksang Tsongkhapa debate, and found those very, very helpful. So then in terms of, I won't say conclusions, just observations. From all of the above, we can see that perceptual relativism is a problem that Buddhist philosophers have been struggling with for thousands of years, making sense of it via ethical, idealistic, and non-foundational philosophical viewpoints. These narrative and possible texts also appear to illustrate an intriguing aspect of Buddhist discourse and literary history, a literary heritage. Texts embody and represent the crystallization of perhaps thousands of debates and conversations of a given subject, like a hub of knowledge and opinions that's now stored and that perpetuates itself through further discussions, further conversations that eventually crystallize into a new line of inquiry and the text that represents them. This is not necessarily a perfectly linear situation, as you have exegetes preempting arguments, like I mentioned, some cover preempting Nippon, or responding to arguments that have not yet been written, or only become written down at a later time. You also have philosophers developing arguments from previous authors. But in essence, then, Majamaka discourse and debate seems somewhat timeless. A sphere of metaphysical inquiry spanning 1,000 years, whose major players seem to be in constant dialogue with each other, reaching back or forward across time to respond to preempt, and to support the various insights of previous scholars. Perhaps simply because facts about fundamental reality are never old, or for that matter, new. Thank you very much.